I would like to thank very much the organizers for this gorgeous meeting. I enjoyed everything. It's very exciting from the physical point of view, and also the environmental conditions are excellent. Thank you very much. I'm going to present some data, and particularly experimental data on the superluminal tunneling and some applications. In the introduction, we have developed in the meantime, particularly for some theoretical conferences, open, very simple equipment and very set up where you can watch on a macroscopic scale quantum mechanical phenomena. I will show you some experimental setups in the introduction, and then I shall show you that we found an empirical relationship for all tunneling times. That means the tunneling time tau for opaque barriers, long barriers, is 1 over the frequency of the carrier of the signal, or 1 over the energy of your particle, if it's a single photon or a single electron. Then I present some signals, real physical signals. I don't want to discuss this problem of group and signal velocity. I think this was solved 80 years ago already. And then I shall show you some transmission data, superluminal. And another highly interesting point is the partial reflection of a barrier. And then I come to some experimental applications in photonic tunneling and in electronic tunneling. We were several times invited to conferences, in Zurich, quantum mechanics conference in Krakow and in Germany, and we developed a setup where you can watch very easily that a barrier is transmitted at a velocity compared to the air faster than the velocity of light. And these are parabolic antennas in order to have parallel light. That's very important for the frustrated total reflection, to have parallel beams. And in this case, for instance, we had a barrier, I will show you, on a macroscopic scale with a signal velocity 8 times the velocity of light. The barrier is really huge. We have a periodic heterostructure of dielectric plates, 5 millimeter perspex, and about 40 centimeter long. This is a parabolic antenna for microwave at around 10 gigahertz, 3 centimeter wavelengths. You know this dish. By the way, I got it many, many years ago, surplus from the American Army in Germany. That's a weather radar. And the other experimental setup is the same, but in this case, we measure the reflection by a barrier. We just have the two antennas put on one side in order to measure the reflection. And I want to show you another object which we have studied, a very historical one, 300 years old. That's our perspex double prism. That's really huge, 40 times 40 centimeter. And this is a slit, sorry?
Is that
wax? No, that's perspex, plexiglass.
Oh.
I think the English name is perspex. I learned plexiglass and perspex. I was taught that there's a company, it's saying, oh, that's English, that's perspex. It's plexiglass. The refractive index in the microwave range is 1.6. And why is this so from the physical point of view interesting. You can split such a cube, and then you have a tunneling barrier, maybe in air. And it's really interesting that Newton already 300 years ago conjectured that the reflection does not take place here, but inside the wall. Even his idea was that light is composed of corpuscles, of particles. Obviously, this barrier is an elastic one. That was his impression. So there is a bending of this barrier. So you can study in such an arrangement whether there is a shift, which is called the Goose-Henschen shift. And this was predicted by Newton, as I mentioned, 300 years ago, that the geometrical point of bend is not here, but here, inside the barrier. And you see, this is, from the mathematical point of view, one-dimensional tunneling. So we have again the barrier, the antenna, the parabolic antenna, and then we can measure here or here the time of the reflected and the time of the transmitted beam. And we have carried out several experiments. I was so surprised. It's amazing that there is not much known since this system is investigated for more than 300 years now. And for instance, it's not known the dependence on the beam widths, on the polarization. There are no theoretical work. There are some theoretical models, but they don't describe the experimental available. And there is not much on the phase, on the Goose-Henschen shift. The problem is that all these calculations were carried out with plane waves. And with a plane wave, you never will find a shift. And that's interesting. This was carried out recently and published last year by one of my PhD students, Astrid Heibel. You can split elegantly if you have a symmetrical beam geometry, then you can measure reflected and transmitted beam, and you will see we found that the same time. That means the time for crossing the barrier is zero. It's a very simple and elegant experiment. And you can prove that the shift, the Goose-Henschen shift, is along the surface of the first prism, and then you have the transmission, the tunneling, the evanescent mode to the other side. Yeah, about up to 3-4 wavelengths. Otherwise, the intensity is too small to detect in such an open air experiment. Sorry?
You can show that for a symmetric surface, the two times are strictly equal whether or not there's a phase.
Sorry, I didn't understand.
You don't need to be in the opaque limit to the two times.
Yes, it's true, that's true. But if you are not in the opaque limit, then you don't have the defined tunneling time. So 2 years ago we came across the idea that all tunneling time in the literature published so far seems to represent a universal time. For instance, in the case of photonic tunneling, we found data on tunneling with the double prism, the so-called frustrated total internal reflection. Frustrated means part of the reflected beam is crossing the gap. That's the reason for the frustration. However, by the way, this is used widely because you have a resolution of 10⁻⁶ in the refractive index. If you put some material in this gap, then you can measure a change of the refractive index up to -6. I supervised a thesis at the Max Planck Institute in Mainz on polymerization, and they could measure on this way how long the molecules are, whether they are 10, 12, or 7 molecules long chains with a resolution of 10⁻⁶ relative, of course. Photonic lattice and the undersized waveguide. And we were surprised. We have a collection here, the barriers. Frustrated total reflections, double prism here from different groups and different frequencies. That means the reciprocal frequency. We observed results which are except this one. We have a good agreement with this empirical relation. Tau, T means reciprocal frequency. The oscillation time is the frequency. And photonic lattice, Ephraim and Steinberg and Chow measured at a frequency reciprocal to this time. And they measured with their single photon experiment a tunneling time of 3.13 femtoseconds, Spielmann. And we have measured 81 and 115 picoseconds. In the undersized waveguide, this was, by the way, the first experimental evidence for superluminal tunneling, 1992, we have measured 130 picoseconds, and the reciprocal frequency was 115.
The frequency is simply the standard frequency?
No. Depending. In the case of the single photon, it was the frequency of the photon. Of single photon, and in the case of our pulses, like in Spielmann or in our experiments, it was the carrier frequency of the signal, the carrier frequency. And in this case, and last year, it was published by a Russian group from the Academy of Science in Moscow, Zekatsky and Liptokov, the first electronic tunneling time. Why is it so difficult to measure the electronic tunneling time? Since we have the tunneling diet invented by Zaki in 1962. There is no data available until now. It was the first. The problem is in the semiconductor, you have so many parasitic effects, the interaction with your impurities or with defects, and this costs a lot of time. And that's the reason why you have never measured the electronic tunneling time. And this was carried out. I have made a simple sketch what they did. They measured the field emission. That's a work function, metal, and they applied electric field and they measured the tunneling time. And they found 6 to 8 femtoseconds depending on the electric potential and according to our empirical relation, we would expect something like 7 femtoseconds. And it's not surprising if you look at the Schrödinger equation and the other theories, you would expect that this is the same. That means electron tunneling and photon tunneling. Yeah. Oh, sorry, I don't understand.
Is there any requirement for the treatment on the cycle of the wave?
No. No. So that's just a Puck barrier. Opaque means, you know, the product of the imaginary wave number times the length of the barrier. That's the only condition. And there was, in Italy, a meeting 2 years ago when I presented it for the first time, and there was a theoretician, Esposito. He developed a theory, and which is in agreement with our experimental empirical relation. Esposito. He published it in Physical Review, I think. Sometimes.
There's a small condition or a weak condition that you can apply here, I guess, that the wave or the pulse is a narrow band pulse.
Sure, I come to this point now. Signal. That's. But this holds for everything. You have defined the electron energy within a bandwidth, narrow bandwidth. But tunneling is an elastic process. So the photon or the electron either moves or not. You cannot change the energy of the electron or the photon. It's an elastic process. So that's what you know from textbooks on Fourier transform. And this is a frequency band limited signal. That means you have a range where you can observe, where you can detect components of your signal, and that's important. Something you cannot measure, this is not physics. And this is, for instance, an example. If you have this frequency bandwidth, and this would be the dependence on the angle on frequency, where you can determine the different delay times of the group, of the phase, and of the front, and the limit of the front is given by this relation. That means the limit for omega infinite frequencies, and this is never defined in a physics signal. And this is the dilemma, also from every textbook. If we measuring, for instance, with signals in the microwave range, 10 gigahertz, this is just simply a cosine function where we have frequency components only between 9 and 11 gigahertz. And according to the frequency, to the Fourier transform, this gives you the signal in the time domain. And according to Fourier, you would expect non-causal components. No, never, ever somebody has measured them. These non-causal components. And this is an exact real physical signal. That's the intensity, this is the field strength. And all these ringing, non-causal ringing, have never been measured. Presumably, I don't know. So you have even, it's in the technical systems, it's even worse. You have both frequency and time duration limited signals. This should be infinite. And there's a famous theorem given by Shannon, 1945, that's a product, which is non-causal. However, it's working physically. That's a product of time duration and frequency bandwidth is exactly the amount of information presented in your signal. So that would completely non-causal according to the mathematical description by Fourier transform. Yes, please. That's exactly the dilemma. That's exactly the dilemma.
Experimentally, there's absolutely no way I can produce that spectrum you have on top graph. Because experimentally, I have to go on and turn on my machine.
Yes, within, gradually, I will show you. Gradually. And you agree, an organ pipe, for instance, is defined. There's a cutoff in the frequency spectrum. You cannot emit by an organ pipe a wavelength longer than twice the length of the organ. That's a cutoff by geometry.
That's a steady state response to the organ pipe. When I first go in and start to blow my air to the organ pipe, it takes a while for it to know that they've got to build up that interference to create that cutoff. So I don't agree with
that. That's a stationary state. But we start here. That's when we start.
No, there's some time that you turn your machine on.
Yes, exactly. But gradually. You cannot, there's some inertia and there's some cutoff, frequency cutoff.
Any some moment where I hook the power in the wall.
But you cannot do it, you can nothing switch on faster than, let's say, some milliseconds. No,
but
no,
you. Go way out in the early tail, and I see that it's eventually zero.
Yeah, but you can do this within a time duration of, undefined time duration of some milliseconds.
Well, it's still not that spectrum.
No, that's exactly this range.
As long as there's some value before which it vanishes, then the frequency spectrum has to drop off algebraically. Yes. You'll never get the frequency spectrum to drop off faster than algebraically.
I think
that's right. It doesn't matter when you decide how early you decide to turn on the switch before your t equals zero. The fact is, it's zero somewhere, and that forces
the That's very simple nowadays. You can analyze your signals by frequency. by a network analyzer, and then you will be surprised. This looks like this.
No,
if I go into the network. No, I have several no, frequencies. That means that's no, that's below, let's say, in the network analyzers, 10 minus 10. And that's you cannot measure because it's less than 8 bar times omega. So it doesn't exist.
So, Professor, are you saying that Fourier transforms are somehow irrelevant to physical phenomena?
Yeah. Yeah, that's the dilemma of physics and theoretical physics. The Fourier transform. Otherwise, no, you should read the paper by Shannon. We have both a time duration limited and in a classical transmission system and in frequency band. And this is exactly how a signal is starting. If you switch on your generator or you switch on your violin or you start your trumpet, then it's a gradual starting and there's a first zero.
But it doesn't matter. Somewhere there is a non-gradual start.
Yeah, but I told you, you cannot start your violin faster than within 1 millisecond. Your generator, my microwave generator, needs some nanoseconds in order to get to the first zero, to have the first, and that's the bandwidth. That's exactly the bandwidth. This is given by the bandwidth. Of course, this is the low frequency the high frequency components. The way you start your generation, you start your signal.
It's the signal without an edge. Is that right?
Sorry?
It's the signal without an edge. Without
a
front. You know, without a front.
Yeah, this is an undefined front. The front is undefined due to the bandwidth.
This is what we're really discussing.
Yeah,
now,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
Does the signal have a front? If it has a front, can you observe the front?
Yeah.
What's the character of the front if there is one? That's what we're really talking about.
Yeah, yeah.
In my claim that all signals have a front. You're saying that the front is smoothed out because of the bandwidth of the system.
You don't know where it's beginning.
It still has a front. There's still a point where it's zero.
No, it's called a envelope. The engineer is telling this an envelope. And in the front, there is no information. The first information you obtain is the first zero.
That adds another element, right? You add the element of information. What we should pay attention to and what we should not pay attention to is related to your remark about Shannon. So
I think you started a generator in the class. Undergraduate class, we have some, and always the oscillation starts this way. If you have a forced oscillation generator, then it's always starting this way. And this is exactly how a microwave generator, how a laser, all of these systems start this way. It's a forced oscillation.
Well, this is a theory. Realistic apparatus. Right?
Yeah.
This is the NIMS.
Or physics. No, that's NIMS. No, that's from class books, from textbooks.
Okay. But within our little seminar, we can call it the NIMS theory of realistic apparatus.
Thank you.
and this theory is that every apparatus starts with band limited, time limited, absolutely smooth, edgeless.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's called by Briand in his famous book, a gradually beginning.
Yeah, okay. But just
a gradually beginning of a signal, gradually.
Describe this in mathematical terms. Not use one of these functions that Professor Chow wrote very early on.
It's very comfortable to use all these Fourier transformation without frequency band limitation or time limitation.
No, but if I go to Shannon's theorem, if I have something that's time limited, absolutely zero. And then I don't care how gradually, slowly you turn that on. Shannon says that in the frequency domain, it is not band limited.
Of course, the result of the Shannon theorem is the frequency bandwidth times the time duration is the information, the content of information. Oh dear. The frequency band times the time duration is the information.
Is that bandwidth? Is not.
mean that the function drops to zero.
Oh, that's a...
All the changes, it's like the full width of half maximum that he puts in his final information.
Now, for instance, on the, yeah, I will show you a signal, a technical signal you are using every day. So that's how a forced oscillation starts and may be shifted. And what I wanted to remind you, a signal does not never depend on its magnitude. So half its, for instance, is always the same as the zeros. Otherwise, for instance, the cellular phone I mentioned several times has a dynamic range of 9 orders of magnitude. You can detect a nanowatt and one watt. And this is how you communicate with the telephone or with your computers. A digital system developed by the Bell Company 10 years ago. The carrier is the 1.5 micrometer wavelengths, and there are digits. One, the half it gives you the information. And where is the front here, by the way? I don't see a front. The front, the bandwidth is 10 minus 6. That means the front is defined within 10 gigahertz compared to 10 to the 14th. That's the definition of the front. And here you see the same signal amplified a little bit after 9,000 kilometers. The information is still the same. So half it's and it's some noise. So, and what is going on if you are tunneling such a system? Sorry? Yes, please.
I was just going to ask a question. It seems to me this is interesting. It seems to me that there's a little transition going on here. You're forcing attention basically for the first time in the seminar now. Forcing attention on the notion of information transport, as opposed to the transport of other things that we've been talking about, like energy and so on.
Yep.
You're forcing attention on the notion of information transport. That's what this picture is about. It's about information.
By the way, information means energy. Otherwise, you cannot detect it. You can detect only by photons, by energy. You agree?
No, I don't agree.
You don't agree? You can detect
no
energy?
Information is entropy, not energy.
That's right.
I don't know any detector who can give you information without absorbing or having a photon-electron interaction. Yeah.
But information is not energy. It is entropy. It's more than just energy. Mm-hmm. Energy is not.
Yeah, I agree. Energy. But information has energy.
No, but it's not the converse. It's not true. Just because you detect some energy doesn't necessarily mean you detect information.
Yeah.
Shannon's is much stronger than that.
Yeah.
Just because I see some photons arriving doesn't mean that there's new information carried by the photons that I receive.
So if you send one electron and the detector makes click, so it has the energy of the electron.
It doesn't necessarily. Well, I can take a very simple example.
And I understand the difference between the difference, of course, the entropy and energy. But you need energy. You cannot detect information without energy. You agree?
Yes.
Okay. And of course, there's more.
Before you remove that graph, if I take my threshold, you're saying that these pulses represent information. So if I move that threshold up by 10% or down by 10%, I can change what you're calling information speed. Just
no.
If I arbitrarily move my threshold up.
No.
But if I drop 10%, I see that comes sooner than I would have.
If it's longer or higher, then
slightly higher or slightly lower, then I see that bit sooner or later.
No.
Why? Just draw that line 10% lower.
No, that is not what I showed here. This is the same signal, but a different size.
Right, so I detect the...
So the information, otherwise you couldn't listen to a wireless.
Okay, I can go in there and tweak my threshold down slightly lower.
Oh, it's opposite. Usually the cellular phone reduces the power, and it's specialized for 1 nanowatt and reduces the power if it receives 1 milliwatt. There is no amplifier. That's a damping.
Yeah, I think we should be there. Just let them explain this. You can actually go before we start.
Yeah. Anyway, oh, I can give you another. Do you think the signal from a far distant star, which decreased by many, 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 many orders of magnitude before you receive the signal, does it move with the velocity of light, even if it is decreased in magnitude? And it doesn't lose information. So my colleagues from the astronomy department told me, we know from the Kerr frequency, the heat of the event, if it's X-ray or gamma ray, then we know the heat, the temperature of the star collapse, for instance, and from the half-width of the signal, we know how much energy was involved. So it does completely being independent, the information on the size, whether it's so small or it's so large.
I'm not quibbling with the size, I'm quibbling with where you decide to put your threshold.
What do you measure the half-width?
Why half-width? What if I do 40% width or 60% width? The actual arrival time when I decide to click there depends arbitrarily on my choice of where I put that cut.
No, you have always to wait until the end of the signal. For instance, a melody or a word, if I tell you 21, you have to word. Yeah, I didn't want to discuss this. Because I think this is a problem 80 years ago was solved. Now I show you some superluminal signals. This is from Longhi and co-workers in Italy, published last year. And they sent such a digital signal on the glass fiber or through a barrier. In the glass fiber, they prepared the glass fiber as a barrier, 20,000 wavelengths long by doping. And you see the band, the forbidden band with the evanescent mode. And this is the spectrum of the signal, very narrow. So that means all frequency components of this pulse have two tunnels through this barrier, and they belong to the Corning Optics company, and they send it on the glass fiber, and you see the velocity was 2 times the velocity of light. And this is interesting because this is compared with propagation in air or in vacuum. However, if it's compared with the propagation of the glass fiber having a refractive index of 1.4, it's even a better improvement. They have, instead of 63 picoseconds, they have an advance of 120 picoseconds. So this is of interest in applications. Whatever you tell me about non-causality and frequency band limitation, this is a signal which has propagated and detected 120 picoseconds earlier than it would have been moved through air. And through the glass fiber. Sorry?
They've been renormalized, or they, when they were made, were they
sure
reconciled?
Sure.
And they were scaled?
Sure.
If they were left on their original intensity scales, would all of the peaks lie within the original peak propagated through the vacuum or through air? See if it can answer the question. Put all those on the right.
I know what you mean.
Would they all lie within the original envelope propagated forward?
This takes place in the case of non-frequency band limited signals. But in the case of, you are coming out only if the shift is more than one pulse lengths. You don't come out. But that doesn't matter because you have the detector has to measure the complete signal, independent on its size, in order to determine, in this case, the half width. And as I mentioned before, usually they damp it down or they amplify it now with instantaneously with the erbium stimulation that doesn't cost any time. The erbium amplifier is stimulated, is working by stimulated emission, and stimulated emission doesn't cost any time. Sorry?
It adds noise.
It adds noise. Yeah, where is the noise, by the way? Yeah, of course. You don't like it, but you will see they sell it already. And that counts. And it's more evident, I mentioned during the discussion, if you send what's usually done, a signal, a long signal without end, and that's the melody, like Mozart 40. And if you have an amplitude modulation here and here, for instance, the distance, the tone is different. You don't see it much. It's only a megahertz modulation on the gigahertz carrier. However, if it's tunneling, then it moved. Oh, thank you. Then this tone has moved the zeros at a speed of 8 times the velocity of light. The zeros, the tone you are listening to here, and if you push it back, just make it, then you will see there is no reshaping. No, wait, sorry, this one. Yeah, there's no reshaping because the bandwidth is so narrow. I just put it back, you understood? No, I shift this back in order to have the same position now on the time scale. I pushed this back. The tunneled, I pushed back. Yeah, just in order to compare it whether there is some pulse reshaping, and there's no pulse reshaping. That means, you see, the tunneling process did not, because it's again a very narrow frequency band.
User, I would suggest you call this pulse distortion rather than pulse reshaping. They're different terms. Just to prevent confusion. That's not pulse reshaping, that's pulse distortion.
Oh, he's saying that there isn't any, whatever you call it.
Oh, a pulse, you can have pulse reshaping without any pulse.
This is pulse reshaping. This is pulse reshaping, Raymond. This we have published and calculated several years ago. This is pulse reshaping. If you have an infinite bandwidth, you see the half width has decreased. This is a tunneled one, and the front is the same. The front is moving with the velocity of light. This is pulse reshaping.
That's reshaping, I can just think shifted.
No.
Yes, that's right.
The content.
For me, the word pulse reshaping means pulse shifting.
Yeah.
Okay. For him, pulse reshaping means pulse distortion.
No. Also the change of the frequency components, which didn't happen in my frequency modulation.
You change the frequency components.
Yeah. That's very important.
Yeah.
That's important. No, I think I agree with you. That's pulse reshaping too. In the case of frequency modulation, for instance, you see it. Now I come to the next point. We were interested in partial reflection. As I mentioned before, it's very easy to study with a double prism. And you can also study it on front of a barrier. We were interested in the time, the information from the back, and now we come to your calculations. let's, we put on a barrier two mirrors. Instead of the barrier, placed two mirrors. And the length was 40 centimeters times two, that means 80 centimeter length. That means times 0.8 times 3.3 in vacuum, the nanoseconds, the time. And that's exactly what we expected. From here to here, these are the two reflected signals. Time, intensity. And then we put in this place a barrier, the same barrier I have shown before. And then you see a small reduction in reflection because it's not a, really a puck barrier. However, you see there's a very small time shift, exactly the tunneling time for transmission. You see also in the reflection. And then you decrease the length and nothing changed. That means the information about the barrier length is within the tunneling time available at the front. And that's a fascinating aspect and tells you that an evanescent mode is a non-local field. There's no time for a stationary field because in this time of 100 microseconds, you cannot travel up and down and have a stationary state. You understand? No?
The problem,
yeah. You told me that you have a stationary state. So that means the information is there within the tunneling time we have measured in the transmission. 100, in the case of microwaves, is about 100 picoseconds.
But if you just change the definition of how you're expecting it, from what I understand, that first tunnel signal, which is out of some little small blip, will eventually have a big signal that comes later. For everything that you've been doing in the past so far, you've been saying, just pull it half back. And that's where you're supposed to find where your information is. Now it seems like you've already switched your definition, saying, oh, I'm going to use much more sensitive detector now and look at the time you look
at. No, not a much. Much more sensitive detector. It's the same detector, and
one way or the other, you're not going at the full width at half maximum. The total signal transmits through the device.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas what you've been telling us before is that you have to go to the full width at half maximum. That's what defines information. Whereas that's not what you're doing here. You go and launch this pulse going through, and now you're trying to tell me that there's something that looks information like to only the very front of the signal going through.
No, I can show you. I can show you the complete signal.
Yeah, so then show me the time at which it goes
forward half max. And you see there is, there's nearly one, 0.95. So the incoming signal is nearly the same size as the reflected one in this case. So you don't have to argue about the detector sensitivity.
No, I'm not worried about that. I'm more concerned about your definition of that information. You say I'm supposed to go to the full width at half max.
Yeah.
So I don't see why you're telling us anything about this little tower.
Is this moved down? What did you mean?
The resonator is fully pumped up here.
Yeah. No, not in within this time.
Not in that time.
So you see, this is the time for the resonator length. From here to here. This is 2.6 nanoseconds. And we got the information about the length within 100 picoseconds within the tunneling time. That means you have a non-local field inside the barrier. And this is very useful. You know, Corning, for instance, is selling such a barrier to have a better mirror than a metal mirror. Instead to have a cavity for light emitting diodes, because metal mirrors, if it's a little bit longer, then you have one. A metal has always some absorption due to free carrier absorption, and an ideal lattice, say I have shown you, say offer you 2 centimeter long, 20 millimeter long barriers, they have a reflection of 0.99999. Without losses, So this is nowadays used in optoelectronics as a shorting or as a mirror in for improving the qualities of the cavity of a light-emitting diode or a light-emitting laser. And another thing what we are working on, and you can use this as a modulator. You can change, for instance, here the refractive index. Then you will get the information within 100 picoseconds. You can modulate signals. And there's a joke, just a funny, you can measure by frustrated total reflection the end of the Earth if you can measure the reflectivity by frustrated total reflection, because you get the information within the tunneling time. You understood? I have a sketch, sorry. Total reflection. here this one. You can use this by frustrated total reflection. This, you measure the reflection, and the reflection depends on the distance, x. So if you have orientated your plate to the moon, then you get some, if you can measure r, let's say 60, 70 orders of magnitude, 99999, you understand? But in theory, it's a Gedanken experiment. You can even measure up to the end of our cosmos if you could measure the reflectivity. And in this case, you can measure it within one tunneling time. Whenever you have a change in the reflective index, then you measure, due to the frustrated total reflection, a change in the reflection within the tunneling time. That's a Gedanken experiment, yes. Yeah. Now may I show you some? This was what I mentioned already, that what is you can buy. The mirror, that's a couple of, oh, that's ingenious, they dope it, the glass fiber, just by changing the refractive index by 10 minus 4 and at a length 80,000 lengths, that the photonic lattice, and it's working. And you can use it as a transmission and as a modulator, as I have mentioned before. And we suggested also to improve electronics. In the case of electronics, it's much more important, because the electron velocity in a electronic device is very slow compared to the velocity of light. Let's say even the ballistic transport is 2 orders of magnitude smaller. So in this case, you would have a great advantage by 2 orders of magnitude in speeding up the electron transport. And one possibility would be very simply, you can dope silicon by germanium slightly, only slightly. Then you have a band edge, a periodic band edge, which means you have a electronic one-dimensional lattice. And in this case, you can couple, for instance, different devices, and you can speed up your electronic device. And another thing, this is a basic of the Esaki diode. You can use, this is a conduction band, valence band, you have interband tunneling in the Esaki, in the tunneling diode. However, you can prolong this distance just by doping. The doping profile, you can vary it between 0.1 and 10 micrometer easily. And then you have a tunneling. That means you can produce in this way interconnections from one transistor to the other one. And you will tell me, oh, you are losing, let's say, 90% of the power. However, tunneling is only reflection. Tunneling is not dissipation, dissipative. And if you have a smart circuit, then you can collect the reflected power and recycle it. I think my time is over. Yeah, I have come to the end. So these are, I have given some examples for applications of superluminal tunneling, and I think tunneling allows energy and signal velocities. Signal velocity, in my opinion, that means I can send a digit or send a frequency modulated signal at a velocity faster than the velocity of light for short distances. At least photonic and electronic tunneling time is universal. That's very interesting, but independent on the system, as I have shown you from several experimental investigations in the optical and in the microwave infrared region. And even I was very happy when I came across this paper last year from the Russians that even the electron tunneling time fits into this empirical relationship. And what we found from the reflection measurements, that tunneling is a non-local process. All informations on the barrier height and barrier lengths are known within the tunneling time tau, as I have shown you. Superluminal tunneling has been observed now in photonic and in electronic barriers. And my conclusion is that superluminal velocity shortens the time span between cause and effect. However, they cannot be exchanged. Effect and cause will not be exchanged. However, there is no possibility for a time machine. I can tell you why, not now, but we have published this, and this is due to the dispersion relation. You need a frequency bandwidth, and then you have that pulse reshaping and so on. I would like to thank some collaborators, Eichmann, Heibel, Mittelstädt and Stahlhofen, and Ralf Vetter, who helped me in this. And if you like to have some reprints, we have published the material I have presented here. You just look on my homepage. Thank you for listening to my talk.
Mm-hmm. So in that case, I'm very interested to hear what you have to say about the event experiment, where the time span actually is negative if you use the group velocity definition.
No, I don't believe in negative.
Okay, so somehow those
in the total, in the effective, in the total effective. You know what I mean? There is a time shift, there is a negative group velocity, I agree. Yeah. But this does not change the
okay, so it's velocity. Not be a signal velocity, but in the tunneling.
Yeah, I agree. No, that's due to the fact that you have in the other experiment and in the other media, you have always a real part of the refractive index. You don't have in the case of tunneling. In the case of tunneling, you have in the barrier only an imaginary refractive index, and this gives you no time according to the phase time. But the time, the tunneling time is raised at the barrier entrance, you know. But we can talk about later.
So the bottom line is that in Vitoom's experiment, did the exchange cause an effect for negative group delay?
Yeah, but I don't have time. I have some slides here to show you why. In the theory of this, you assume that signal is a point on the time scale. And this means the frequency spectrum has to be infinite. And this is what the theoreticians in all these relativistic books don't know or don't realize, that a signal has to have some frequency extension if the time is nearly zero. You understand? And due to the dispersion relations with all the medium, you have talked about this, you have a long signal. And this means the beginning of your signal is maybe end in the past. But not, you have to wait, for instance, for the lottery. You have to know all the numbers, 21, 63, and until the end. The end will be in the future due to the dispersion relations. So you cannot change cause and effect.
What if I hit a short signal?
A short signal. Yeah, that means you have to have a very broad frequency band.
Did you say that you can shorten the distance between the frequency band below the limit? I think I heard you say it's below the limit of the L over
C. Yeah.
So it means you can find a lot of frames by the 2i, actually.
No.
Now
we can talk about this, and I explain it why. But fortunately, we cannot exchange.
Since you mentioned the paper by my former student Esposito,
yeah,
I would like to mention that even before by defining a tunneling in time, in our way we showed that under some approximation your relation, your heuristic relation holds, both for electrons and for photons. And we also, I will give you more.
You should give me, yeah.
Where theoretically we.
Yeah. No, I agree. I thank you.
Okay, so I think at this point we should make a little coffee break.